Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last month, Fox News anchor Gretchen Carlson filed a sexual harassment lawsuit against Roger Ailes, the founder and now former chair of the media giant. More than a dozen women have since contacted Carlson's attorneys to also report accounts of unwanted sexual advances and inappropriate sexual comments by Ailes. The New York Times interviewed more than a dozen women and witnesses who reported the problem went beyond Ailes and was workplace-wide. They all spoke on the condition of anonymity, citing embarrassment and fear of retribution. According to reports, after Roger Ailes resigned from Fox News, he received $40 million. High-profile cases like this shine a light on the pervasiveness of sexual harassment, from Fox News to UC Berkeley to the National Park Service. Women working in restaurants, retail, agriculture, hotels, homes, and male-dominated fields such as construction face the highest rates of sexual harassment. It affects one out of every four working women in the United States, according to the National Women's Law Center. But 70% of women who experience sexual harassment don't report it. That's according to a survey conducted by the Huffington Post. Joining me today to talk about how to prevent sexual harassment and how to improve protections are two guests. Jane Cao is the principal of HR Law Consultants. Jane advises employers on all aspects of workplace laws, including sexual harassment prevention. In 2013, Jane provided testimony to the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission on how to prevent sexual harassment of employees with disabilities. And Jane joins me in studio. Hi, Jane. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Maya Raghu, Director of Workplace Equality at the National Women's Law Center. Maya works on a range of issues, including pay equity, pregnancy discrimination, and sexual harassment. And she joins us on the line from Washington. Hi, Maya. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So the Fox News sexual harassment, I guess you can call it a crisis because so many women say they were sexually harassed, has really got a lot of people talking about this issue. And, you know, when you look at the numbers, it's really hard to know how many women and men this affects because so many people don't report it. Jane, you brought in some interesting statistics. What would you like to share with us?
Well, California is one of the few states that requires mandatory sexual harassment prevention training for large employers with 50 or more employees. But year after year, California lands in third place in terms of the total number of complaints that are filed with the EEOC across categories and sex-based claims for sexual harassment, sexual discrimination. And interestingly, very often when I present this kind of data in my trainings, I get this kind of, dubious looks saying, well, isn't it because California has, such a large population and therefore there are more complaints? But also on the top 10 list are smaller states like North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Tennessee, where population size doesn't seem to affect the volume of complaints that are filed with the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So clearly this is an issue that not only we're seeing in the headlines, but here in California, we really have to address this in the workplace because the data supports it.
And what would you add to that, Maya? I mean, how pervasive is this issue?
Well, as you pointed out, Jane, we don't have a good handle on the numbers because many people are afraid to come forward and report what's happening because they're afraid of retaliation or losing their job, and ruining their career, their future career prospects, and being blackballed. So the numbers that we do have are underreported. But what we do know is, as you also mentioned, when someone who is in the public eye, who has some position of authority, like Gretchen Carlson, comes forward and talks about what happened to her, it brings many more people forward out of the shadows and gives them some encouragement and empowerment to come forward and talk about what happened to them in their own workplace.
And of course, these women were making incredibly high salaries and had very high-profile jobs. And we'll talk about the differences between, you know, a woman making more than $1 million and, say, a woman working for a Motel 6 or a Walmart you know, in rural Oklahoma. I mean, what happens to those women? But can you talk, Maya, just about what strikes you about the Fox allegations? I mean, even in 2014, there was a book written by Roger Ailes by Gabriel Sherman called The Loudest Voice in the Room. And he wrote about how Roger Ailes would interview women and make them twirl around in front of them. If a woman wore pants on screen, he didn't like that because he couldn't see her legs. I mean, he told women to wear short skirts while they were on the air, and almost every woman on Fox is always in a short skirt. So what really strikes you about the Fox case?
So a few different things. Number one, I think it shows that sexual harassment is an issue in every workplace across America. Like, no one is immune, regardless of their occupation or the industry in which they work. Second thing is that even though we've made tremendous progress on this issue over the last 40 years, you know, sexual harassment wasn't even recognized as a form of sex discrimination until the late 70s and early 80s. We can see whenever we have these public or cultural moments and discussions around sexual harassment that it's much more prevalent than people think, and the kinds of behaviors people are describing are still as horrible and sort of unbelievable as they were in the 60s, in that Mad Men era. Hmm. So, for example, the allegations that were in Gretchen Carlson's complaint are, and the allegations made by the other women at Fox, are not just about, you know, sexual remarks or a kind of hostile environment, but really this quid pro quo of demanding sexual favors in return for keeping your job or getting a promotion or having access to some sort of opportunity in the workplace. And the last thing I wanted to say is that it shows that sexual harassment is really dependent on this power dynamic. So as powerful as Gretchen Carlson and the other women at Fox might have been, Roger Ailes was this incredibly powerful man within Fox and still was able to exert pressure over these women based on the allegations.
And Jane, Roger Ailes left Fox News last year, but he got $40 million reportedly to do it.
Yeah, and what kind of incentive is that for women to come forward and report it if somebody gets an exit package that large? I think that really sends a message, doesn't it? You know, we're not going to wait until the investigation concludes. We're not going to wait until we resolve this issue with the complaining parties and talk to the women that might still be working there, but we're going to exit him out with a huge package. And I think that as this story gets played out more in the media, that there's going to be more emphasis on what kind of message is that sending to.
And some of the women still have their jobs, but other women do not have their jobs.
That's right. Including Gretchen Carlson,
right.
Who's, I think the bigger story with Fox News, a bigger, you know, there's a lot of talk about what happened, the sexual harassment, but I think she may have a stronger case for retaliation because she allegedly rebuffed his sexual advances, and ultimately that resulted in them not renewing her contract. And so there's some actual tangible adverse action that was taken against her for not acquiescing with his advances.
And then when it comes to the legal aspects, there's been a trend of employers requiring binding arbitration agreements. And so in the case against Fox News's Roger Ailes, his lawyers are pushing for a private arbitration, citing a clause in Gretchen Carlson's employment agreement. Can you explain these legal terms to us and how this works?
Well, binding arbitration is where the parties can privately resolve their dispute in front of a third party who can decide whether or not there is some validity to the claims and decide what the damages might be. What's happening now is that Gretchen Carlson's attorneys allegedly are saying, well, she might have signed an arbitration agreement, but that was with Fox News, and Roger Ailes was not a party to that agreement. So therefore, they can't compel her to submit this her lawsuit to be resolved through private arbitration. It's not binding on these two. So and that may be the reason why she tactically did not bring a lawsuit against Fox, because she knew that would be the eventuality.
And as Maya said, so much has changed, so much awareness has been raised since Anita Hill accused Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas of sexual harassment 25 years ago. I mean, this issue is getting so much attention in the military, on college campuses. There's the women who are launching, you know, catcall. They're raising awareness about being catcalled on the streets. So, Jane, what's really changed since then?
What's really changed? It's interesting. When the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas situation was occurring, I was in law school, and I was interviewing for jobs at law firms as an employment lawyer, and I watched it so very closely because it was so informative as to how women are questioned about their claims. I think what has changed is greater awareness. She did bring the topic to the national forefront, and how very often, you know, it's difficult to complain to your direct supervisor, your boss, who happens to be head of the agency. Mm-hmm. So there has to be other vehicles. Roger Ailes headed Fox News. He was in a very powerful position. There needs to be other avenues, whether you can go to the board of directors or you can go to someone above Clarence Thomas, who's head of the agency. There must be other channels for victims to report their concerns. So that sort of and it also changed the dialogue a little bit that, you know, despite how graphic the details were as to what happened to Anita Hill, it really raised awareness that these things happen in offices, not at construction sites, as you might see on television, but even at the EEOC. So I think that she created a dialogue around that, and it changed the way that we investigate these complaints.
Mm. Maya, what would you add?
Well, I would just say not only does it raise awareness of the issue, I think part of the reason sexual harassment resonates so much with the larger public whenever we do have these high-profile cases come up is because for a lot of people, they don't necessarily think of what they are experiencing at the workplace as sexual harassment. But when they hear someone else talk about it and talk about it on the news, their light bulb might go off and they might realize they know that what's happening to them is wrong, but they might not think of it as sexual harassment and may not know that there are things that they can do to address it.
I also wanted to ask you both about another high-profile case that hasn't gotten that much attention. It involves the National Park Service. There was an investigation in January documenting how multiple female employees at the Grand Canyon were repeatedly propositioned for sex and were targets of unwanted attention by male employees, some of whom were their supervisors. Another investigation released in June found similar sexual misconduct at Canaveral National Seashore in Florida. This is according to a Washington Post story. And you really cannot make this up when you're talking about misogyny and patriarchy in this country. So the Washington Post had a piece saying that as the National Park Service confronts what Interior Secretary Sally Jewell has called a culture of sexual harassment, the agency allowed barely clad swimsuit models to take photos with iconic park backdrops. These shoots, used for the first time last year in the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue and reprised by the National Geographic, have angered park watchdogs who say the images undermine the efforts to fight sexual misconduct. So, Maya, are you familiar with this? I mean, the National Park Service is dealing with sexual harassment while at the same time they're having women pose in swimsuits in national parks for Sports Illustrated.
Well, I think what this illustrates, and the story about Fox News as well, is that so much of what is driving this is culture, the workplace culture, and what is the message that the company, the employer, is sending or not sending about how it wants to address this issue. Because it's one thing to have a policy and conduct training. That is responding to the issue of sexual harassment, but it's not getting out ahead of it and actually engaging in prevention. And in order to prevent sexual harassment, you have to get at the cultural norms and the social norms in that workplace which make these kinds of behaviors and actions acceptable.
Well, what do you think about that, Jane? Because you do train companies across the board, and Maya says it's one thing to train employees, it's another thing to change the culture in the workplace.
That that is the challenge. And training is part of creating paradigm shifts. And we're going to probably see Fox News do training of the entire organization after this.
And maybe allow women to wear pants when they're on the air?
Right. Wouldn't that be a breakthrough? So how one goes about changing cultural norms is really the challenge. And as an employment lawyer, as an HR consultant, as a trainer, you know, you can help sometimes shift outmoded views and stereotypes and entrenched ways of interaction in the workplace through training. I mean, that has to be a vehicle, particularly bringing in someone from the outside who can tell them, look, here are the bright lines. It's not all that gray. There are some pretty bright lines in this area, and getting everybody, including the very top of the agency, the very top of the Fox News, the very top of the corporation, to buy in and mandate that they too attend the training. Because, you know, I'm sure Fox News probably had some training, but did Roger Ailes attend any of them? I mean, that's going to be a question. You know, did he see fit to make sure that he sent himself to these training programs? I mean, I think that is really a part of the...
And does it matter? Because in some cases, you can just be on your phone throughout the whole training and not take it seriously, right?
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. And is there buy-in from the very top of the organization? That's really the question.
That is Jane Cao. She's principal of HR Law Consultants. She advises employers on all aspects of workplace laws, including sexual harassment prevention. Maya Raghu is director of workplace equality at the National Women's Law Center. And today we are talking about sexual harassment. The Fox News case really got a lot of people talking about this, but obviously it's not just Fox News. There are high-profile cases at UC Berkeley, the National Park Service, which we just talked about. And then you've got women working in restaurants, retail, agriculture, hotels, a number of male-dominated fields. So we'd love to hear from you. If you have ever experienced sexual harassment in the workplace, what was your experience like? Did you report it? Why or why not? How was it handled by your employer? And then the really big issue here is changing the culture of the workplace. What is the culture of your workplace like? And have you ever experienced a major shift? So we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet at yourcallradio. And let's hear from Deborah in San Francisco. Hi, Deborah. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. This is really touching a raw bone for me because as a 59-year-old woman who considers herself a feminist, throughout my life I have witnessed from friends and other people and personally experienced sexual harassment in workplace situations. I spoke to your screener about the fact that a very good friend of mine, when I was living in Pittsburgh in the early 80s, late 70s, ended up in a discrimination, sexual harassment case against, or made a complaint against U.S. Steel. She was working as an executive secretary for one of the executive vice presidents in the company, and she was harassed so much for making the complaint that she had 24-hour surveillance by detectives. She felt like her phones and mail was being gone through. She had such intense pressure during this period of time that I honestly don't know how she survived it. And, of course, the consequences ultimately was that the person who was harassing her was given a promotion and a raise. Mm. She was had to sign non-disclosure forms and basically was close to a nervous breakdown through the process, and really went through holy hell with U.S. Steel. And I think, honestly, part of it was because she was hired not only for her efficiency, but she was hired because she was an extremely attractive young woman, and she did not feel that it was required in her job description anywhere that she has to put up with the kind of harassment that she got from her boss. And she's not the only attractive woman that I know that has gone through this. In different circumstances, there have been waitresses I've known who've had absolutely horrific experiences. There have been other people in retail and other places, including in the real estate business, people who were exceptionally attractive young women had such a response from the couples and the males in the couple that their response was so overt in their attraction towards the attractiveness of the person that it soured the real estate deal, and they ended up having to drop out of real estate because they were simply too attractive, and not that it was their fault that they were attractive, but the responses towards them was completely out of control, and they could not prevent people from behaving in ways that were completely outrageous and offensive.
Wow. Well, thank you for calling in, Deborah. When you shared the story about your friend who faced discrimination in the 80s from U.S. Steel, I was just thinking about how today it's so easy to find someone because of social media, right? And so in the 80s, you had to do a little digging, but today it's so much easier.
To find out
where my Twitter account, my Facebook account, right? I mean, it's easy to find someone's personal information to take that discrimination, that harassment to another level.
That's right, yeah. And that's something I talk about in my trainings with supervisors in particular, in that with social media, it's become a very powerful medium. Gretchen Carlson is on social media posting about the progress of her lawsuit and about women coming forward. So suddenly, even though she's no longer on Fox News, she still has followers, and the word is getting out. So it's sort of it disrupts the power balance a little bit because the other message to supervisors is, look, all someone needs to do today is to Google your name when you're looking for another job, or when they want to get to the bottom of a specific story, some allegations or rumors they've heard about you in the workplace. And Google has become a permanent repository for salacious accounts. And
right. It'll
stay with you forever.
And Deborah says that after her friend filed a complaint, she was followed, and she felt like people were going through her mail.
That's incredible.
How common is this?
I have not ever been involved in an investigation where that was an allegation. So that sounds really, really outrageous.
Maya, have you heard anything like this?
Not necessarily during the investigation process, but certainly we know that stalking is often a component of sexual harassment, and frequently harassers are very strategic about who they target. And they might watch and observe their target for a while to sort of pick their moment and figure out who the best victim might be. So certainly surveillance and stalking is not uncommon when it comes to sexual harassment.
Well, thank you again for calling and sharing those stories, Deborah. Today we are talking about sexual harassment. 70% of women who experience sexual harassment don't report it, according to a survey conducted by the Huffington Post, for fear of retaliation, for fear of losing their jobs. And we'd love to hear from you. If you've experienced this, we'd love to hear your story. Did you report it? What happened? We're talking about this today with Maya Raghu. She's Director of Workplace Equality at the National Women's Law Center. And Jane Cao is Principal of HR Law Consultants. She advises employers on all aspects of workplace laws. And if you've ever been to one of these trainings, did you think it was effective? And what are your thoughts about changing the culture in the workplace? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call. On the telephone, sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio, tweeting us at Your Call Radio, or by going to our website, yourcallradio.org. If you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone, you may call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. T-A-L-K. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. We'll have your say from the BBC coming up in just a half an hour at 11 o'clock here on 91.7 KALW.
On tomorrow's Your Call, Jonathan Balcom will join us to talk about his new book, What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. Humans Kill and Eat, trillions of fish every year, but most of us know so little about them. So we'll talk about fishes who feel pain, they use tools, they conduct elaborate courtship rituals. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. And then on Friday, it's our media roundtable. Today, we are talking about sexual harassment. In 2013, 10,000 sexual harassment charges were filed, but a survey by the Huffington Post found 70% of women who experience sexual harassment never report it for fear of job loss or retaliation. And if you've experienced sexual harassment in the workplace, we'd love to hear from you. What happened? Did you report it? How was it handled? If you've ever gone through one of these trainings, which is required in the state of California, what was that like? And what about the culture of the workplace? That's the big question. How do you actually change the culture? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet at yourcallradio. Today, we are joined by Jane Cao, Principal of HR Law Consultants. She advises employers on all aspects of workplace laws, including sexual harassment prevention. And Maya Raghu is Director of Workplace Equality at the National Women's Law Center. We've been talking about Fox News, the National Park Service. There's also the 19 UC Berkeley employees who've been found to have violated the school's sexual harassment policy since 2011. According to Mother Jones, over the past year, a vice chancellor, a famed astronomer, and a provost have all stepped down from their positions amid public outcry over the university's response to sexual harassment claims and the perception that UC Berkeley protected these powerful men instead of helping their accusers, some of whom were students. Jane, what are your thoughts on what's happening at UC Berkeley? This just keeps escalating.
Yeah. I mean, one story after another, we're shocked, and then we're shocked again. And this can't be. The case that really came to the forefront last year before the dean of the law school was accused of harassment. It involved a tenured professor who was a Nobel laureate who was found after a six-month investigation by their Office of Prevention of Harassment and Discrimination that he had violated for something like a nine-year period the university's harassment policies, and multiple women came forward and claimed that he tried to kiss them, touch them, grope them, did all kinds of things, and some of them didn't suffer in silence. I mean, they were, they tried to report this. Some students took it upon themselves to confront him directly about this. But ultimately, it was the investigation that brought this to light, and word began to spread about this, and the academic community signed a petition, and fellow astronomers, he was in the astronomy field, began to demand stronger sanctions and demanded that he drop out of leadership positions in their sort of organizations, even though he later posted an apology. Thousands of scientists and fellow astronomers and faculty members demanded that he step down, not just from his positions of leadership, but that he could no longer perform his functions as a faculty member. So he ended up resigning. So what we're seeing is that when the employer or the university fails to take appropriate action, the community is now stepping up and saying something must be done, and this cannot continue. You can't simply have somebody resign from a leadership role, but are they fit to be an instructor, a professor, a vice chancellor, a dean, in an educational institution involving young women? Mm-hmm. Can this be allowed? So I think it's really shining light on an area, an academic setting where these complaints went largely ignored before then.
And again, this is happening in the year 2016. After we see these high-profile cases at an institution like UC Berkeley, do you see major changes implemented, say, across the UC system?
I can't speak for UC. I don't represent them.
Right. Or if something big like this happens, do you see major changes implemented.
Yeah, and I think that that's what we're reading, is that they are now, the chancellor is now stepping up and saying that we are going to take all necessary measures to prevent this from happening. We're going to institute much stronger protocols, and we're going to do more training, and we're going to ensure that these policies are enforced, that it's not up to the discretion of somebody higher up to sort of turn the other cheek and ignore these concerns when they're brought forward. We're going to have clear complaint mechanisms in place. They're going to be thoroughly investigated by trained individuals, professionals, who can do a prompt, thorough, and objective investigation, and they'll take remedial action. So that's the word. I don't have any insight as to their practices beyond what I read.
And Maya, what are your thoughts? Do you think that we'll see major changes after something as explosive as this at UC Berkeley?
I would hope so, because as Jane pointed out, it's multiple cases, one after another, in different contexts, which again points to a real issue of culture at the university. And addressing a cultural problem demands really a comprehensive top-to-bottom response in order to get to the root of the problem and to get rid of it. I also wanted to point out that the point that Jane made about the importance of peer and coworker pressure in these situations. The university reportedly had known about what was happening, had received reports, but really started to take action when other professors within the university system and those outside of it started speaking up and pressuring the university to take action against this professor. And that is also something we see in other contexts as well. And I think it points out the importance of coworkers stepping up and voicing their disapproval of sexual harassment. That's part of how you get to culture change. And I would just point that out in contrast to Fox News, where until Gretchen Carlson came forward with her allegations, apparently many things were happening behind the scenes to many people, and even when she spoke up, she did not receive support from some of her coworkers.
Right, and I also, you know, I can't help but think, let's say Gretchen Carlson got a raise or a promotion, would she have spoken out?
Or her contract renewed.
Right,
that's
what I mean, right.
That's
what did it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The straw that broke the camel's back.
We have a caller who wants to remain anonymous, who wants to talk about UC Berkeley. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. I just wanted to say that I think that a lot of what is going on at UC Berkeley is actually cosmetic, and that there aren't any substantive structural changes taking place. And I wanted to connect a few dots. First, I wanted to say that the University Office of the President has known about the UC Berkeley situation going back multiple years. I actually filed a complaint in January of 2009 that to this day has never been investigated. And the person with whom I filed the complaint is Denise Oldham, who is the current head of the Office for the Prevention of Discrimination and Harassment. And she has actively and demonstrably covered up cases. And she was actually named as one of the people in the Title IX suit for covering up sexual assault and sexual harassment cases. And if the university were sincere in its efforts to really change this situation and not to have a cosmetic approach to it, she clearly would not still be investigating these cases when there is proof that she can't be trusted to actually investigate them properly. And I also wanted to say that Janet Napolitano was one of Anita Hill's lawyers, and so it's particularly disappointing that someone who knows this situation intimately really hasn't shown the kind of leadership that one would hope, given the extent of the problem at UC Berkeley. And I also wanted to say that we need to think about the different kinds of retaliation that happen depending on who speaks up, and the ways in which, for example, race can complicate who will be believed. And earlier, one of your callers said that harassers are strategic in who they target, and that they go for the most vulnerable people who they know can be most easily silenced or discredited. And so, you know, things like race or class or disability or other, axes of social difference that make you less likely to be supported and believed definitely affect who is targeted and who was retaliated against. And the last thing that I wanted to say is that I really hope that there will be more investigation of UC Berkeley to see, you know, what is occurring in terms of accountability issues, because so long as Denise Oldham is still in her position, I don't think that people should feel that much is changing at the university.
Would you mind telling us about your complaint?
I don't want to go into specifics. I actually feel like I've said as much as I can.
Okay.
And I don't think I can be composed.
No, that's fine. I was just curious. But thank you for sharing your story. You know, you remind me of a show we did in January about the documentary The Hunting Ground, which is about rape on college campuses. And we had Sophie Karasik on the show. She is a sexual violence activist, anti-sexual violence activist, who was raped on campus at UC Berkeley and said that administration did not support her whatsoever. In fact, a number of women in the film said the same thing. And so, Jane, I know you can't speak to the specifics, but how do you deal with this? I mean, so many women are accusing major, major institutions of, first of all, not taking any action until a number of students get together and force them to, or in this case, the community gets together and forces administration to take action. And then secondly, when they do take action, our anonymous caller says that it's basically cosmetic.
Right. You know, it's interesting because we're seeing more and more of these cases being filed against universities. And the issue when it comes to liability under Title IX, it's not Title VII, which is the workplace law. This affects any educational institution that receives federal funding, colleges, universities, and the like, the University of Alabama, University of North Carolina. The question there is, if the university took these matters seriously, what kind of efforts they took to investigate and take corrective action once they were aware of the concerns. So Penn State. It goes on and on. The list goes on and on. I just read an article in the New York Times, I think, last week about Baylor University. And I think that's the Christian university that was headed by Ken Starr, who we all remember from the Clinton investigation. Following receipt of complaints of sexual harassment and assault, Baylor University did hire an outside investigator, but ultimately there was no published written report. And the affected parties, Conference 12, you know, various different groups have asked for disclosure of this report with all of these findings. And the outside investigator was told not to prepare one. So I think transparency is really important. And that's what the caller is referring to. Where did her complaint go?
Right.
Where's the tracking? Did it disappear into the ether? Who got back to her and told her that we've taken this matter very seriously, we're going to investigate this, and we will now discuss, you know, the findings with you and attempt to take corrective action where it's warranted and so forth. So there needs to be communication to the parties about what is the status of their complaint, what measures are being taken to address it and take it seriously. And following an investigation, what are the findings? What are the steps that are transparency is really important here, and communication with the parties all the way through. I mean, these are things that, you know, need to be done across the board.
Well, thank you for calling in and sharing that story. And that is Jane Cowell. She's principal of HR Law Consultants. She advises employers on sexual harassment prevention. And Maya Raghu is director of workplace equality at the National Women's Law Center. And if you'd like to join us, we're talking about sexual harassment, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can tweet at Your Call Radio. And we have another anonymous caller who would like to talk about UC Berkeley. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, yes. Actually, I'm the person who spoke before. I just wanted to point something out, which is, one, I know Sophie, and I actually, was one of the people who was with her speaking to the Department of Education Office for Civil Rights about the situation. And you know, the other thing that I wanted to say, especially in response to what was said about Jeff Marcy, is that, you know, I think that the public should not be fooled into thinking that the professors uniformly speak up about the situation or support students. And in my case, professors, including female professors, were actively helping the university and Denise Oldham to retaliate against me and to cover the case up. And, you know, I can tell you for a fact that professors who helped to cover my case up are signatories to the Berkeley Faculty Association anti-sexual harassment statement that came out a few months ago. And so, you know, a lot of what is happening around the response at UC Berkeley is professors kind of jumping on the bandwagon now that there's a spotlight being shown on the university. Mm-hmm. But I think going back to the issue that has been raised about changing the actual culture and the normalization of abuse and the pervasive hierarchy that allows this situation to occur, that is really not taking place.
Well, thank you. And speaking of culture, we have an email from Joe who says, I don't think we can change the culture of the workplace without changing the culture at large. And the culture at large, there is a demand for women to constantly sexualize themselves, even in the least sexual of situations. Marketing sexual attractiveness is a 24/7 job, whether for those Cal students or for the Fox anchors, who, once again, are required to wear short skirts and tight outfits when they're on the air. Maya, can you talk about that?
Absolutely. And Joe's right that the culture of the workplace is absolutely influenced by the culture at large. And movies like The Hunting Ground point out, you know, the rape culture and the sexualized culture that we live in this country. And to get at the root of that problem, what you need is, and there's been a lot of discussion about this lately, is prevention education for students, not just for students that are in college, but starting much, much earlier, as early as elementary school or junior high, and talking about respect and respectful relationships and treating each other with respect in order to stop that sort of sexualized behavior and sexualized expectations from beginning in the first place. So it's not something that can be solved with just the training, although training is incredibly important, but it has to be education and it has to start early and it can't just be in the workplace.
I mean, I can't help but think about families who are hiking in national parks and they see women in tiny bikinis being photographed for Sports Illustrated. I mean, what do you tell your kid about that? I mean, we can do an entire show about changing the culture, but Jane, what would you add?
The training aspect?
No, the email about changing the culture at large, not just the workplace. It's about so much more than that.
Absolutely. And I find it very interesting to take it into a larger context to talk about our politicians and public officials who are making comments that would not be acceptable in the workplace, that would clearly be a violation of workplace laws when you stereotype women or Mexicans or any other group, that would be a violation of, you know, federal, state, local laws. And yet these are some of the role models that we have today, our public figures that are running for office. So I think that it's a challenge. It's a real challenge.
Well, speaking of public figures, Alternet has a piece, a Trump National Golf Course worker fired after she complained about sexual harassment. The Daily Mail obtained court documents relating to a female former employee at Trump National Golf Course who alleges that she was fired from her job after complaining about being sexually harassed by a former colleague.
Oh, there you have it. Yes.
We also have an email about male responsibility in all of this. Camille writes, where are the men who will stand up for women's rights? There needs to be more responsibility placed on men to change their culture. Where is the male feminist movement? Maya or Jane?
You know, I just read an article, I think it was last week, about the bro culture in the finance world on Wall Street. Mm. And it's written by a man who was a trader or, you know, in one of these positions on Wall Street. And he talks about how he silently stood by and watch this happen in order to be accepted into this very, very male-dominated world. And he silently stood by and really just talking about how men have an obligation to speak up as well when this occurs, because it can't just be one half of the population, the affected population, if you really want to transform the culture of a place, right? And so I think it is important that anybody who witnesses this, who's not even directly affected, know that they can't suffer retaliation for speaking up. And there are multiple channels. There's multiple individuals you can go to, that it won't be ignored, that it's going to be taken seriously. So I do think that there's a role for men and women to play. Mm-hmm. And men can be victims, too. And
right.
we've seen, you know, that the volume of complaints filed by men, whether it's male-on-male harassment or female-on-male harassment, there's definitely an uptick in claims filed by men as well. So I think it's important that they speak up.
What explains that, the uptick?
You know, it's hard to know. Mm-hmm. I'm not a sociologist, but I think people are more aware of their rights in the workplace, and you know, that there's no shame in coming forward and saying that I'm a man who was sexually harassed and this was unwelcome conduct of a sexual nature and I didn't invite it. And, you know, I have rights too to work in a harassment-free workplace.
We have just a couple minutes left. I also wanted to talk about what people deal with in low-wage jobs. Maya, your colleague Fatima Gross-Graves gave testimony in 2013 saying that workers in low-wage jobs often have little bargaining power and can least afford to risk their livelihoods by reporting harassment. She also spoke about restaurant workers, women working in the restaurant industry, particularly women who rely on tips to supplement a sub-minimum wage, are among the lowest paid workers and experience sexual harassment at high rates. So can you talk about what low-wage workers face?
Sure. And I think this goes to what your earlier caller mentioned, which is how harassers target people who are vulnerable for a variety of reasons and who may be more easily silenced, either because they don't have a lot of power in the workplace or because outside the workplace they may have an uncertain immigration status, or their family member also works at the organization and they're afraid of retaliation against them as well. So there's a variety of factors that go into making workers in low-wage jobs particularly vulnerable to sexual harassment. We know that based on a report from the Restaurant Opportunity Center that up to two-thirds of the workers surveyed reported that they experienced sexual harassment from their managers, their coworkers, and customers. And customer sexual harassment is incredibly common in these types of jobs, whether it's restaurant work, retail work, hotels, and a variety of these kinds of jobs. Restaurant workers in particular are vulnerable because they do depend on a tipped minimum wage. So the tipped minimum wage right now is lower than the regular minimum wage. It's $2.13. It hasn't been raised in years. So workers are relying on the tips they get from customers to make up that wage, and they're supporting whole families on what they get. So they have little incentive to challenge a customer or confront a customer who's making them uncomfortable or who's sexually harassing them. And basically what the report found is that workers have to accept sexual harassment, and it's becoming normalized as part of the industry in order to survive because of the wage structure.
Mm. And then you have agricultural workers, many undocumented. There was that amazing Frontline documentary, Rape in the Fields, a couple of years ago. One survey found out of 150 female farm workers in California's Central Valley, 80% experienced some form of sexual harassment. Maya, did much change after that documentary aired? It got so much attention.
It did, and they also did another wonderful documentary last year on Rape on the Night Shift, which deals with people, the cleaning staff in offices in California. So I think some things changed. A lot of it, as we've been talking about today, is driven by the employer and the message the employer is sending and the employer's desire to address this issue in good faith and really get to the heart of it. So you know, it's happening on an employer-by-employer basis. Sometimes it's happening as the result of a lawsuit, and certainly the EEOC has brought many, many cases against employers in the agricultural industry for sexual assault and sexual harassment issues. And sometimes that's what's driving the change. But on the other hand, I was involved with a project a couple of years ago based in Florida in the tomato industry, where wonderful workers' rights organizations were able to come to an agreement with some of the leading growers and producers in Florida to sign up to a voluntary code so that they are engaging in prevention to make the working conditions better for the workers and allow them avenues for reporting and addressing sexual harassment and sexual assault.
This was with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers?
Right. It's the Coalition of Immokalee Workers and their Fair Food Standards Program.
Yeah, they do amazing work. We are almost out of time, Jane. 30 seconds. Final thoughts. What can the average person do to change this situation?
The average person or the average employer?
Well, you can take employers since
yeah,
that's your focus.
I think there's a message for employers, too. I mean, you know, the onus can't just be on the employees
right.
to change the system, to change the culture, to hold the employer accountable. But employers have a large role, and supervisors in particular. And, you know, I think it's important for them to recognize that when complaints are brought, that they have an obligation to report it, even if the complaints are directed at them. And workers very often won't come forward and say, I feel like you're sexually harassing me, but they might say, you're making me uncomfortable. What you just said or did is really offensive. That is a complaint of sexual harassment. They need not use these magic words that this is harassing. They could simply tell you that you made them uncomfortable, that this was unwelcome, and that is a bona fide complaint that should be taken up with HR. So even complaints that are directed at you as a supervisor or a manager ought to be reported to HR.
Well, we will definitely do a show about changing the culture at large. That's really important. Jane Cao is principal of HR Law Consultants, and Maya Raghu is director of workplace equality at the National Women's Law Center. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, Jonathan Balcom discusses his new book, What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. Humans kill and eat trillions of fish every year, yet most of us know so little about them. Fishes feel pain, use tools, and conduct elaborate courtship rituals. Balcom gives fishes a voice, diving into scientific research and evidence to explain how they perceive, feel, and experience the world. What does a fish know? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.